I guess there's, I mean, there's probably a lot to be said, obviously, about the role of the new kind of technologies that we're talking about, particularly I think blogs and wikis and other collaborative technologies in just changing our way of interacting with information and knowledge to begin with. I think that's really quite an important shift, and then how that translates into the educational context, of course, is very interesting as well, because for one thing, the students coming into education now really will have a quite different understanding of information and knowledge than people did, you know, 10 years ago. And the kind of the skills that they need to gain as well in their education will be quite different again, because they need to be able to deal with these sorts of, you know, open access systems with these really broadly distributed creativity and collaboration systems as well. And these are quite different skills from traditional work, I think, as well. And of course, academics or teachers themselves will need to learn how to use these things themselves as well. And that's not a trivial problem either. I think, I mean, the use of blogs in teaching to begin with is very interesting. I think blogs are fantastic, obviously, in terms of, to begin with, reflective journals, I suppose, for students throughout their academic careers. I think it's a great way for them to work out where they're at and how they're developing as students, how their knowledge is developing, how their skills are developing, and so on. So simply for reflection, there's a lot of you know, teaching situations where people have used reflective journals in paper form already for a long time, but I think blogs are so much more useful in that respect. Also because you really enable the students to interact with one another as well, of course, and share their experiences and share their information as well. So in terms of that, it's very useful, I think. I think, you know, the use of blogs beyond that as well in terms of, you know, the sharing of information, of course, the collaborative development of content, if you like, is very interesting as well as a tool for interaction, for I guess co-creation, you could call it. There's some very interesting uses for blogs as well, and depending obviously to some extent on the system that you're using as well, the technical features of the system may enable some of these things more or less or better than others, but by and large, I think that's a really important way of really getting people to interact and to work together as well, particularly at an early student level, I think, too. The teenage diary thing, it gets a lot of bad press, but to some extent it's actually a really important part, I think, of blog use as well, because, again, it's that kind of self-reflection as well, which actually isn't such a negative thing at all, particularly for people like students in their first few semesters or so, who are really out of their depth in a different environment and need to come to terms with that environment. So being able to reflect on their experiences there through a blog is very useful. And I think we're looking to use it increasingly also for what we call PASS, peer-assisted study schemes, where basically students in second semester support students in first semester by sharing their experiences with these younger students, newer students. So being able to point to people's blogs that way is actually quite useful, because someone in first semester can see, well, hey, someone else who did this a year before me had exactly the same problems, had exactly the same experiences. So it's really good to take the edge off and make people less anxious, I guess, about these new experiences. So I think, I mean, the journaling, I think, isn't such a negative thing at all. It's just that, of course, if that's all you see of blogs, they don't sound all that exciting, or they seem, you know, quite, you know, often, yes, like you're saying, quite narcissistic, I suppose. But beyond that, of course, I mean, there is a lot of interesting phenomena that are occurring because of the interactivity of blogs that's possible, where I can link my content with other people's content and really build my social networks, of course, and build them very much ad hoc and in a very shifting way as well. And that's a very interesting way for people to interact, of course. To start with this assertion of narcissism, I guess, to begin with, I'm not sure that there's necessarily all that much wrong with using blogs in that way in the first place, even if that was all that blogs were used for, because I think the ability to write about your daily experiences, the ability to reflect on what's happening in your life is actually quite an important one, which is really why people have written diaries, you know, for centuries now. And I think certainly that in itself isn't necessarily a negative thing. In some ways, again, it's not, you know, yes, you can find these things if you're looking for them, but if you're looking for them, then obviously you've got a desire to find them in the first place. So I, in that respect, I'm not sure it's necessarily such a big issue, but I think where blogs really go, of course, what blogs really enable is that interconnection of content and that ability for people who have similar interests, who have similar problems or whatever it might be, to find one another. And I think that's a really important addition that certainly doesn't exist in traditional diary writing. And you know, whatever the circumstances of the blogger are, whatever the content of the blog is, you know, that whatever we think of them, whether we value them or not, whether we see them as morally sound or not, or whatever, you know, certainly the blogs enable people with similar interests, with similar life stories, perhaps, to join together and to interact with one another. And I guess there's, you know, yes, of course, you can apply, I guess, moral judgments of whether what they're doing is good or not, or whether what content they're writing is good quality or not. But in the end, it's about individuals, I guess, finding one another who have similar interests. And I think that's almost always a good thing. I think too, it's interesting because probably the same people who are now criticizing blogs for being narcissistic and publicly narcissistic would have been people who were criticizing perhaps the TV generation for being very isolated from one another and not interacting with one another at all. So we're now at a place where people do start interacting with one another based on their shared interests. And I think that's still a step forward from just people, you know, being couch potatoes and being totally isolated in the suburbs somewhere, just, you know, doing nothing at all social, online or offline. There's obviously a huge interest, like you're saying. There's been a study by the Pew Internet and American Life Center recently, which was something like, I think, yeah, 58% increase in blog, I forget if it's access or blog writing. I think it might even been blog writing over just the last year alone. So that's a massive increase, obviously, in users. That shows that something is happening. What exactly is happening is of course, quite another question still. Why are people doing this? Is it to do particularly now? I mean, in the last year, was it simply a factor of having the U.S. election and people looking to find additional information on what was going on? Was it simply that blogs kind of the word kind of appeared everywhere, so everyone was checking it out, and will it gradually die down again, or just become a smaller movement again? You know, I think there is certainly a fairly profound shift that is happening there, where people are more and more interested in creating their own content, of course, in putting their own views out there, whatever they're about, even if it's just about their own life experience or their neighbors or whatever, all the way through to talking about politics and talking about, you know, the music that they like, the movies that they like, whatever. There's certainly a real interest of people in getting their ideas out there and sharing their ideas with the world, I think. Now, what will happen there probably is that, you know, there will be a certain amount of overload, of course, too, and there's a huge amount of blogs out there. As I think, if you look at some of the work that Alex Holloway has done on this, you'll see a lot of blogs that basically very few people ever visit and very few people even link to. And you've got, you know, a very small number of very heavily visited blogs that kind of everyone reads. So there's an interesting question of how many of these millions of blogs are actually really being looked at, being read. So, you know, the question of you know, the quality or the reach of this information that's being put out there is quite another one, of course. What I find really interesting, I think, in that respect is, though, the kind of the blog aggregation that's happening through sites like Daypop and Technorati and so on, where really it's not so much about the individual blog anymore, the individual site that's writing about something or other, but it's the broader trends that you can see emerge across the blogosphere. Through these sites, where you can see that particular terms suddenly are extremely in extremely high use, you know, from one hour to the next or from one day to the next, and it's a very good way to track what currently is on people's minds, if nothing else. And I think that is a very fascinating insight into current events, into current thinking, and in itself is a fantastic phenomenon. I think it's really much less about the individual blog these days. It's much more about the interlinkage of blogs and the the travel of information across the networks, probably, that that blogs enable through trackback, through interlinkage, through commenting, through RSS feeds, of course, and so on. So through all the ancillary technologies, I guess, that there are now for blogs. And there'll, no doubt there'll be more as we go as well. There'll probably be a movement of blogs onto other devices as well. I mean, it's happening already, of course, with more blogging and so on, but I think there'll be even more of that happening as people are starting to use their PDAs, their pocket PCs, their mobile phones and so on to blog and to access blogs as well. The question of copyright in blogs is a really tricky one, because there is so much reposting of content, of course, so much reuse of content throughout the blogosphere. I've looked in the past particularly at news-related blogging, for example, and of course there are a lot of people who will simply, you know, quote big chunks of articles from CNN or BBC or whatever it might be on their own blogs, and there's some real questions around, you know, the legality of that, the copyright of these articles. Having said that, of course, sites like the BBC and others are starting to offer RSS feeds for their content now as well, so they're obviously interested in people engaging with their content as well. And you know, I mean, ultimately, I think, particularly in the sort of news field, what probably will happen there is actually that we're moving towards something that's not so different from file sharing in a way, where you get these sort of these themes, these memes, you know, around particular news events that are emerging as the events are happening, and that information will really be diffused, I guess, across the blogosphere. Very much in the way that a shared file that becomes popular is kind of diffused across the file sharing networks, I think. And it's almost, it's kind of like a news sharing system, if you like, where the items, the news items themselves, the news reports themselves, really, you know, they might originate from the BBC or from some other official site, if you like, or they may not, they might maybe do something that a blogger's doing. I think they'll just sort of be shared across the network, probably, and it's actually probably becoming quite hard to track where they originated from, which is a problem in itself, of course, in terms of authenticating this content, authority of the content, you know, the quality of it, and so on, because they get kind of changed as well as they're being shared. So in terms of that, there are copyright issues, there are issues around, you know, the validity of the content that's being shared, of course, as well. In some areas, that's more important than others, obviously. I mean, like I say, in news publishing, in publishing generally, it's probably quite important. In academic work as well, it's quite important, again, for people's own careers, of course, to be seen as the originator of particular ideas. You know, if you coin a new phrase, if you coin a new term or a new methodology or so, then certainly you would want to be seen as the originator of that, and not the person who might have made it public, made it popular on their blog, and who is often cited as the person who spread the word. So I think we'll see more of that. We'll see much more of that happening in the future. And on the one hand, it's a legal question, but on the other hand, it's really much more of a moral question, probably, where it's more about, I think, engaging with content that you use in a moral sense, in a morally sound sense, which is very much, I guess, the same way that open source operates as well, where, you know, yes, I could remove, if I take the source code for Linux, I could remove all mentions of Linus Torvalds or any other contributor to it and then recompile it. But a lot of people just don't do that because they acknowledge the right of these contributors to be seen as being key contributors. It doesn't take away anything from the quality of the software if their names are in there. It doesn't take away anything from me as a user if their names are visible there, or me as a contributor even to the project, if their names are also visible there. So it's much more of a moral issue, I think, of respecting everyone who's contributed to a particular project and keeping those acknowledgements in there as well. And I guess that's where a project like Creative Commons really tie in, of course, where it's you know, something like the attribution license in Creative Commons, of course, is exactly that. It basically just says, well, you can do whatever you want with it as long as you attribute the people who've contributed to this in the past. There is definitely that idea of contributing to something larger than yourself that's in some areas is quite important. I mean, something like, say, the Wikipedia or so, obviously is a fantastic resource because Everyone's got some expert knowledge on something, you know, from whether it might only be football, but it might be something that they are an expert on, basically. So, you know, so they're able to contribute in one form or another on that obscure bit of knowledge that they're really well established in. So if you put all them together, obviously it is something larger than themselves, and they will all benefit from it. I think there's a real question of scale there, of course. The Wikipedia works in that respect because it has a massive number of contributors, and I have no idea about the figures at this point, but it certainly has a massive number of contributors, a massive number of entries now that have been contributed to it. In smaller teams, that's not necessarily the case, of course. If you have a much smaller open source project, for example, a much smaller collaborative project of whatever form, it's not so much perhaps the question of, you know, it being larger than yourself. It may be more of a question of simply sharing the workload. And also, if you really have a small team, a small collaborative team, then it might be just you do this project as a stepping stone to gainful employment as well. You're using this to show off your skills, I guess, and you show off that, hey, you contributed to this great little piece of open software that's been really, really useful. And so you can now get a job with Microsoft, basically. So there is that opportunity as well, of course, to show that you are someone who can participate, who can participate in teams, of course, too, and who really has something to share, I guess, with other teams, with other projects as well. The question of open source, or you know, the question of this open collaboration, perhaps, is still one of which areas will it actually work in? Does it work across the board, or are there particular fields where it will work very well, and particular fields where it doesn't work at all? I'm still not sure that's been fully answered. Even in open source, you can probably find some projects that have worked really well because there's a great need for it and great interest of contributors to work on them. And there's probably a fair few areas where, well, there are people who've contributed, but it never quite got off the ground because it's been such a small project that there are not enough people interested in it. In areas like you know, the open publishing that I've worked on quite a bit as well, I think you see that there, where there are some projects like Slashdot, for example, which has been massively successful because it has, you know, hundreds of thousands of contributors. But there's probably also an area where where sites have been set up that never actually quite worked because people weren't all that interested in the topic itself. No, I think even looking at something like some of the minor sort of sites that are kind of, I'd hate to say Slashdot copycats, but certainly inspired by them, sites like Corrosion and Plastic, for example. You know, some of them, Plastic perhaps is a good example. It's only got about, you know, 30,000 contributors, I think, or registered users, which is much smaller than Slashdot, of course. And I think it's the case of a site that's maybe just made it, maybe just established itself, but because it's got less of a topical focus, less of a real target market, if you like, it certainly hasn't become as popular and as successful as Slashdot, because the common good, or the common interest, wasn't quite seen as strongly as it was in Slashdot. There needs to be a clearly felt need, a clearly felt common need or common interest that's there. And there's you know, obviously there are simply technical issues around the ease of interaction as well, the ease of contributing as well. Something, you know, looking back at the Wikipedia, for example, their first project, the Nupedia, of course, failed dismally because they made it so difficult to contribute. So with the Wikipedia, then they made it open access, fully open access. Anyone can edit, anyone can contribute, and suddenly it took off. So there are simply technical issues, but there's beyond that, there's really a question of, well, is there perhaps a target community that you can address as well? Is there a particular group of people, and how do you find them? How do you, I'd hate to come out with really sort of commercial language, but how do you market your site or your project at them as well? How do you actually address them, attract them, get them involved, enthuse them about the project? You know, these aren't easy questions, I think, for particularly for some of the smaller projects. You know, how then do you manage the contribution as well? I mean, there are real differences, of course, in terms of how open some of these sites are, how much the content that's being submitted is edited, or how much it's possible even to comment on the content that's there, and so on as well. So, these questions, I think, all contribute to the success or failure of a site. Again, something, I've looked at some of the open news sites particularly, and something like Slashdot seems to have worked because its editors, while they certainly have a clear presence, they're not really interfering all that much. They choose the stories that get published, but beyond that, the interaction and the commenting is open to anyone. Some sites like Corrosion and Plastic, of course, it's even the users themselves who collaboratively, if you like, edit the content and so on. And that's certainly a useful approach as well. If you've got other sites where every contribution that's being made needs to be edited first, needs to be approved by an official editor at first, then those sites will probably develop much more slowly because it's just seen as another hurdle to jump through, and it takes much longer, and they're not able to respond, particularly in the news area, they're not able to respond to news that quickly. So these kinds of setup problems or setup options, I think, certainly also affect the success of a site. And in the mapping projects you're talking about, and many other projects where essentially users contribute content, users co-create content, these are really key issues that need to be addressed. And of course, some of these issues are addressed or are driven not only by what would be best for the site itself, but it's also depending on the institutional background of the site. If you are worried about libel, if you're worried about, particular undesirable content being posted on the site, and so on. And these are again things that will influence your decision of how you want to set up and how you want to run your site. Particularly in terms of education as well, it's really also about how we actually use our systems in education. And there's still, at the university where I work, there is an ongoing drive to make learning and teaching much more learner-centered rather than teacher-centered. And I think that's actually quite counterintuitive for a lot of teachers, unfortunately. And it's really something that we still have to deal with much more. Actually putting the learner in the center and making sure that they have the best possible and the most constructive, experience in their learning, rather than just using our online teaching tools as a way to provide information for them. That's a really, really difficult issue. We've got this project at the moment at QUT where we're really looking to set up systems that are supporting much more collaborative and creative engagements using the technology, using online technology for students. And that's a really interesting question of how do you manage that? How do you set that out? How do you really put the student in the center there? How do you make it easy for them to use systems like blogs and wikis, for example? Because that's, you can't just put those systems there and say, oh yeah, now so everyone writes a reflective, blog or whatever throughout their semester, or let's just all contribute to a wiki together and put our thoughts there together. Because if you do that, if you put these systems there, it really changes the entire teaching and learning experience. It really changes around the way that lectures are delivered or should be delivered, I think, the way that people engage with the material in a particular course. I've been using a wiki, for example, in one of my classes, and I'm now getting to a point where I'm really starting to think, well, do I actually need lectures so much, or can I really change the unit, the delivery structure for the course itself into something that's much more like a wiki, that's much more of a network knowledge structure, rather than the sort of linear delivery that's going from week one all the way through to week 13, where I try and give students, say, a history of new media, from Ted Nelson and so onwards all the way through to blogs and wikis. That may be useful for some, but it's not actually a good way of engaging with new media studies, I think, anymore. So I need to find other ways of making the whole width, the whole breadth of information available to students, and then working with them through this into the areas that they're interested in, you know, in a much less linear structure, in a much more flexible, I think, network structure. And that's something that I'm trying to do at the moment. But it's quite a change, of course, in approach from the sort of traditional teaching, the traditional lecturing that you know, we've been trained to do, I suppose. We just habitually do, I guess. The students are actually producing the wiki as part of the unit, and it becomes an encyclopedia of new media terms and concepts, basically. And so, you know, students the next semester can already use the wiki that their predecessors have created as part of their unit material. So more and more, if you like, you know, the content kind of shifts into the wiki, and the wiki becomes the primary teaching tool. And of course, the organization of content in that wiki then is really quite different from what you'd find in a textbook or what you'd find in a lecture series. So, and of course, I still need to provide some way or some suggestions for ways through that content to the students, because otherwise they'll come to the first lecture and think, oh, well, here's all this stuff now, how do I make sense of it? So I still need to help them make sense of it, of course. But it's a very different way of making sense of it, and it's a much more flexible way of making sense, perhaps, than it would be if I said, okay, first, you know, God invented the mouse, and then, you know, and then, you know, we worked from there, and then the internet came along or whatever. It's not that sort of development anymore. It actually, for one thing, it enables students to move through, I think, in a way that's much more attuned to their own interests. So if they're interested in online publishing particularly, they can look at that area. If they're interested in the privacy issues or legal issues or governance issues or whatever, then they can move more into that area. So it enables them to pursue their own interests much better, I think, than if I tell them, here's what you need to be interested in. Here are the different things that you can look at. Blogs are fantastic, I think, in terms of helping with the research itself, as well as with really bouncing ideas off others. Of course, it's very much about being able to put out there some ideas that aren't quite fully formed yet, I guess, putting them out into the public and allowing other people to engage with these ideas and add to them, perhaps. So it's getting back much more to perhaps a traditional form of research, or a traditional form of academic scientific work, I think, where people are really able to work in teams and to share the ideas that they have, perhaps, for others to add to. Now, of course, there's always a problem with that in a highly commercialized form of research, because you're probably unlikely to share your ideas until you've patented them, basically. So there are issues around this as well. But if you can get around those issues, even if you're just having an internal blog for the team itself, it's a really useful way to share ideas and build on individual ideas and turn them into larger projects or larger research, I think. So in that respect, I think it's fantastic, and it's I think the probably the collaboration, the research collaboration that we'll see emerge from blogs will be quite significant, because it really enables researchers you know, in quite distributed locations, of course, to work together as well and share their ideas around. So in that respect, I think it's very interesting. But getting around the institutional hurdles and the economic hurdles of that will still be a problem, because, again, you know, the sharing of information that used to be really quite a standard approach in academia and in science has kind of gone out the window a bit with far more competitive funding regimes and so on, of course, in recent decades, I guess. I think in terms of the artistic side as well, it's a fairly similar approach as well, where, of course, again, you know, there may be artists who are very keen to hold on to their ideas until they're fully formed, so that no one else will build on them before they've had a chance to do so themselves. But again, there's, I think across the board, in whatever field you're looking at, we are moving towards a more collaborative engagement between people. And I think that's certainly true in the arts as well. And I think in the arts too, we get more people starting to use these tools as well as others to collaborate on their artistic work as well in quite distributed teams once again. So I think, you know, blogs are obviously quite useful for that. And I think that's really quite a wide societal trend, I think, the move towards broad collaboration using the net and all its tools. We've seen in the last few decades, probably quite a very strong lack of discourse, I think, a very strong lack of engagement between people, even working in the same fields. And I think largely that was driven perhaps by commercial angles, by intellectual property angles and so on, where people really were just hanging on to their ideas for dear life because they thought this was the way to go. That's the, and you know, you can easily describe that again as sort of the difference between closed and open source models as well. I think it very much maps onto the same onto that idea as well. There's one approach which says hang on to everything, keep everything close to your chest, don't talk about it at all, and only show it off once you've finally developed it, once it's ready to show to a broader audience. But there's the other approach that says, well, no, share widely, which means that you attract the best contributors and collaborators to this, and it will be better for it, and everyone will benefit from it. It's really, it's a commons approach versus very much a locked down institutional approach, I think. And the discursive part of that facilitates, of course, everything else that's happening. I don't think you can have good collaboration without also having good discourse around the collaboration and facilitating the collaboration. So that's absolutely key, I think. And, you know, there's, I mean, we've seen probably, I mean, really since the advent of particularly the internet in a popular sense, we've seen so many technologies that are all about communication and discourse. I mean, from newsgroups and mailing lists all the way through to blogging and you know, content management systems and wikis and so on and so forth, that always have a very strong discursive component as well. So there's obviously quite an acutely felt need for these kinds of technologies there. And it's just a matter of breaking out of some of the more traditional institutional environments, I think, or changing those environments in order to enable that kind of discourse, that kind of interactivity, I guess, that interconnection and collaboration, I think, without necessarily always the first look being at the IP, being at, you know, the institutional boundaries, the economic outcomes, and so on. The obvious question is, in an industrial sense, of course, if, you know, the question about open source again is an obvious example there in the software industry. We're now gradually seeing a move towards more companies realizing that there's value in contributing to open source, even if their main business is in selling software or whatever. We are still in an environment where we're moving into an environment, I think, where open source and the much more open and collaborative approaches are better supported now. But it's been a long, slow change, I think. It will continue for quite some time to come. Until it's really fully accepted, and some people might never fully accept it. So in that industrial sense, in the purely commercial sense, there is a real problem, I think, still, but it's gradually being overcome. In an academic sense, there are similar problems there. There's maybe not so much the question of commercialization always that's at the end of it, but it's certainly a matter of competition between different academic institutions, of course, and attracting people to your university or your institution rather than someone else's. So the, you know, something like the MIT open courseware approach was quite clever by MIT, because it means that, of course, a lot of people will be using that, and many people will then say, well, you know, they're obviously doing something really good there, so I'd really want to go to MIT rather than anywhere else. So in that sense, it's for them, it works. But if everyone just makes their courses available, it probably, I'm not quite sure where that would lead to. I don't think that would be as useful or as effective. If you're the market leader and you make these things available, then it just helps you show your market leadership even more, perhaps. I'm not claiming that, you know, it's a purely calculated, you know, commercial decision, but I think certainly, you know, it's easy to do that if you're MIT, because you're not destroying your market. I think if anything, you're adding to your market. I think, you know, more broadly, the question of academic collaboration or opening, breaking through the academic boundaries, the institutional boundaries, is a very tricky one, because universities are very much, of course, in competition with one another these days. The market, particularly also for international students, is a massively competitive one, I think. There's also, of course, still that question of prestige, of showing that particular ideas were generated at that university, not at this university, and that you are the leader in a particular field, which attracts students and attracts collaborators and attracts staff as well, I suppose. The question is, what is it that would really make universities want to share their knowledge and share their ideas and break out of their own boundaries? And I think even though academics very often want to do that, the university management will still have to work that out for themselves, I think, and see what it is that would really drive them to cooperation there. And that's the conflict there between staff who might be very willing to collaborate and management who don't really see much of a benefit in there yet. For me, it also ties in very much with what we're doing at my university, we've developed a very strong push into the creative industries, what we call the creative industries, which is coming out of the UK environment particularly, and they're really the industries all the way from the arts through to the media, and all the industries built around individual creativity, if you like, and a lot of what you see in that sector is really this move towards co-creation with users, everything from say the games environments where something like 90% of The Sims is now created by its users, there's a huge amount of material that's actually not created by the companies anymore but by the users, and you find that obviously in everything from there down to Big Brother and other TV shows as well, where the audience is becoming much more involved and so many other areas. So there's a real move towards involving users as content creators, as content contributors more and more. And I think all of this fits very well in that field as well. It's really, we're moving away from traditional production consumption models to really the kind of, yeah, the, I guess co-creation is probably the best word I can think of, where it's really about not consumption, but use kind of a mixture of producing and using, if you like. And I think that's a really significant shift that's certainly been happening in recent years. I've actually started using the term producer as a mixture of producer and user, really. And that's, it's very much the same in the same sort of vein, because it's not just about using, it's about being active in that use, being active as a participant, yeah. The interaction with the bigger media firms is very interesting, I think, in a lot of this user-driven, if you like, content creation or collaboration, I think. There's cases, of course, in, something I heard just very recently in online gaming, for example, where the sorts of things that happen in massively multi-user online role-playing games are very problematic, where companies like Sony are trying to shut down some of the things that happen in these games because they're not meant to be in the spirit of the game, really. So, I just saw we had a presentation yesterday by Paula Ledieu from BBC, and she showed something from the Star Wars Galaxies, I think is it, or Star Trek, I forget, one of the science fiction themed role-playing games, where people are now actually getting together to make music videos, where they basically choreograph their movements in a bar in this environment with 20, 30 people or so, and actually record all of that and then cut that into music videos with some existing songs. So the one that she showed yesterday was Chumbawamba, it was a very, very innovative, very creative use of the technology, totally against what the game's really about. And there's some real problems there with the games companies not knowing how to deal with that, not knowing whether they actually want that kind of thing to happen in their games or not. There's been other cases. In The Sims, for example, you had people actually prostituting their characters for money. And so it becomes a little bit too real in a way. It becomes a bit too much like real life for people. But if characters are allowed to do just about anything in the game and there's a capitalist economy in the game, then why should that not be allowed to happen? There's some real question about the governance in those games, basically, that's starting to emerge as well. And, the Wired example, many others are similar examples of that. How do you actually deal with users' creativity, users' work in these game environments, if you like, or in these collaborative environments, if you if it in the end kind of gets away from what your intentions with the environment were. I should actually say, just by way of finishing, I really have to thank a colleague of mine, Peter Mitchell, for lending me both her PC and the camera itself. I've had some real trouble actually getting my hands on the technology, and she came through. It worked out just in time. So I'm glad we could make it.